From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. Nice to have you along. I'm Evan Dawson.
And I'm Megan Mack. We'll open the week in review with the unlikely viral media star from Penn Yan and the Finger Lakes. J.J. Warren is 22 years old. He grew up in a small town, a devout Christian who dreamed of being a pastor. But there was just one problem. J.J. is gay.
And the Methodist Church has had a long debate about gay rights. Back in the 1970s, the Methodist Church drafted official language condemning the LGBTQ community. And earlier this year, the church's International Council voted to uphold its anti-gay positions. Pastors can be suspended for officiating same-sex weddings. You certainly can't be a pastor if you're gay. And gay Christians are urged to change or remain celibate.
Warren spoke at the International Council back in February, a passionate speech about why he wants to stay in the Methodist Church, despite its anti-gay stance. He doesn't want to change. He wants his church to change.
I grew up in Penn Yan, New York.
Yeah. And so, yeah. You know, obviously small town and rather small district. What was life like growing up for you?
Growing up, I was one of seven children. And, you know, the town was very small and there weren't, to my knowledge, I didn't know any gay people. So I didn't know that being gay was something that could be a possibility.
Even now? I mean, you're not that old.
I'm 22.
I mean, you didn't know anybody gay growing up in Penn Yan?
Yeah, no one. And so to have no role models, to have, you know, not to know that this could be who I am, it was really difficult growing up because I didn't feel comfortable because I didn't think it was a reality. And so going off to college was the first time I went to Sarah Lawrence College and just graduated a couple weeks ago. And it's the nation's most LGBTQIA-friendly campus. And so that atmosphere just allowed me to finally realize, wait a second, this is who I am.
But let me back it up before we get to Sarah Lawrence, because that's an interesting sort of juxtaposition, going from a town where you didn't really feel all that comfortable to a campus where you certainly did. But when did you, you know, growing up, it's sort of a, I guess I'll just put it this way. You didn't have gay friends. You didn't know gay people. When did you know you were gay?
Yeah, I think for a long time, because I didn't know anyone who is gay, I just didn't think that you could be gay. I knew that I didn't like girls. I tried to have a girlfriend or two in high school, and that just didn't work out. And so finally, at the end of my high school career, we got a new pastor in town, and he finally pushed our church to have the conversation, to talk about human sexuality, and he was really supportive. And I started to write letters, because after he had said this and challenged our church to include people, there were some nasty letters put on the bulletin board. And so I started to write letters in defense of queer people. And at the time, I didn't know I was writing it for me. I just thought, I'm writing this for someone because God loves them. And somewhere deep down, I must have known that I was actually writing those letters for me. But at the time, I thought, I'm just writing this to help someone else.
How old were you at the time?
Probably 17.
Wow. And yeah. What, I want to be very careful in asking this, but I mean, some of the comments, were they pretty rough?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And so you go to Sarah Lawrence, and you called that the most LGBTQIA friendly?
According to Princeton Review, at least 2 years ago.
I mean, like, it's interesting. I don't know how it's measured, but it's everything is measured somehow these days. And what about the campus, though, in real life and living there made it feel that way?
I think, especially in contrast to my hometown, Sarah Lawrence, just everyone was themselves, it felt. Obviously, not everybody, but the general population, it seems that everyone felt comfortable, for the most part, to be the unique part of themselves, which they couldn't see before. So people would walk around in capes and with all different color hair. And, you know, just seeing partners walk around together on campus, you know, lesbian couples and different types of couples that I just had never been exposed to before. So it really was just a place where it was normal. It was normal to be different, and being different meant you were normal.
Could you have done that at all in Penn Yan, you think?
Absolutely not. I think maybe there was one gay person who maybe my older siblings knew of in high school, and I think they got picked on a lot. There were a lot of rumors about me when I was younger in high school. I never had to hear them, luckily, until I graduated and heard. But yeah, times are changing.
Do you think even now, you're 22, so it's been a few years since you've been in Penyan, do you think that from your understanding of what life is like there, is it different at all now?
I think we're seeing, similar to where the church is today, is that people are starting to question long-held beliefs. And so I was really excited last year that my high school actually had some sort of event for Pride where they talked about trans identities. And so to see that, you know, I remember when I was in high school, the GSA was a big topic at the school board meetings. You know, should the school have a GSA? And what did the community think about that, the Gay Straight Alliance? And so now to see that they had an event for Pride at the high school, just to see how in the last 4 years something has changed, that's given me hope.
I read this weekend that South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg, who's running for president, talked about understanding his own gay identity and said that growing up, if you could have told him that being gay was something that he could have cut out of himself, he would have taken a knife to himself to cut it out because it was so hard. That if you would have told him, here's a pill, you take this pill and you won't be gay anymore, that he would have swallowed the pill before you could hand him a glass of water because of how tortured he felt at times about just the way maybe people around him treated him, the way he felt fearful of discrimination, his own family or community. Did you have any of that? Because it sounds more like when you were in high school, you were sort of wrestling with maybe who you were and getting around to that. But you're not telling me that at 12, at 13, at 14, you knew you were gay, and yet you were feeling all of that oppression. Did you feel anything like that, what Pete Buttigieg just talking about?
I mean, to an extent, yeah. I didn't like to be different, and I didn't understand yet why I was different because I didn't know that gay identity existed. And so I just knew that some part of me was different, and I wished it weren't. And, you know, my older siblings integrated well because we had moved to upstate New York from South Florida. So it was a really different environment. They auctioned a tractor off when we first got there, and we were like, what is this? So it was just a really different place to grow up. And so I knew part of me was different, and I didn't know what it was. And I haven't thought about high school in a while, but looking back now, I got these cool polo boots for Christmas one year, and they were really trendy. But I wouldn't wear them because the first day I wore them, someone said, like, oh, those shoes are so gay. And I really was trying to, you know, protect an image that, well, I can't be gay. That can't be who I am. And so there were things like that, little things like that, where someone would call me gay and I would stop what I had done because I didn't want that to be my label.
Next, let's listen to the experience shared by Asada Evans, a sophomore at World of Inquiry School. She spoke to a crowd at the Islamic Center of Rochester as part of an event focused on understanding the intersection of racism and misogyny. Evans is 16 years old, and she talked about the sexualization of young Black girls.
In this clip, Evans is talking about her own experience, but also the wider effects on young girls who feel the pressure of sexualization before they even leave middle school.
When writing my speech, it came pretty like fluid because it's my personal experiences, and I felt like I just wanted the audience to hear my authentic experience, and then Mara helped me with it and stuff like that. We pulled it together.
Can I ask you, Asada, because you don't have to recreate everything you did on Sunday, but mm-hmm. Can you give me sort of one, like a little sliver or an example of the personal experience that you wanted to share?
The most personal that I got on Sunday was talking about my experience in being an over-sexualized Black girl, because I'm 16 years old and a lot of people assume that I'm a grown woman, they catcall or make sexual remarks or will touch me and stuff like that, and that's very uncomfortable. Or even when I'm watching the media and I see people that may look like me, like as soon as people turn 18, then
It sounds like before they turn 18.
Yeah, before, and then when it's actually legal, that's when they go on it. Yeah.
And Asada, who do you think is most responsible for doing the sexualizing?
Whew, that's a deep one. I think it's society issue, not a gender or race or anything like that. I think it's just society issue because we're all brainwashed. I don't know. I don't believe that sexualization should be like a, I don't know. It's like a trend. It's like a trend and it's nasty. And
I want to ask you questions without planning thoughts in your head, because I'm hearing what you're saying and my mind goes in certain directions, but I want you to feel free to tell me if I'm wrong. Okay. Do you feel that sexualization is monetized? It's an economic good.
Yes.
Yeah?
Yes.
Okay. That was a fast yes.
Me and my mom talk about that.
Okay. So the sexualization in particular, do you feel, I think the term you use, the sexualization of, you know, African-American girls in particular. Do you feel pressure? You know, you're 16 now, but, you know, when you were turning 13, 14, did you start to feel that? Did you start to notice images? Does it start to filter down and reach you in different ways?
Yeah, I was pretty developed, like, by fourth grade. And I had an experience with an 11th grader, and he was talking about me in very sexual ways. And my sister was in 12th grade at the time, and she told administrators nobody did anything. Then my mom got involved. But it was pretty nasty. And it's just very uncomfortable because no one has the right to assume whether, like, you can make, like, you can be confused or guess or anything like that, but assumptions, I don't know, just ask, like, yeah.
Okay. And when you talk about cat calls, you talk about people actually putting their hands on your body. That's happening when you walk down the street, when you're in school. Where is that happening?
It's happened downtown and it's happened in school. My peers and older men have done it. Women have done it. It's, yeah.
How do you generally respond when that happens?
I get very uncomfortable. My stomach, like, gets very tight, and I just make it clear that that's unwanted. And if they continue, then I get angry.
And what do you think is, what's the impact on, you know, African-American girls in particular? But when I'm thinking about young girls feeling that overt sexualization, not everyone... And I'm serious when I say this. Not everyone is like you. You know, you're able to stand up in public and share your stories and kind of bring some witness to a very hard situation. Some people kind of turn inward. And what's the possible negative impact of this sexualization of young girls?
Trauma. Those girls being sexual towards other people, not knowing that it's something negative, because it starts at a young age. I mean, like, this can get even deeper than just talking and touching. This, like, molesting, there's raping, like, all that stuff, and that starts really, really young. So people can grow up in a mindset of, oh, it's okay to do this, and then they turn out doing that to other people, and it's just like a chain of events.
And now, as you're 16 years old, I'm gonna turn back to Mara in a second, because what I don't want to do is I don't want to push too hard here, but you're bringing some really important hard themes I think we as a society have to grapple with a little. Are you able to talk about this with your friends? Do you regularly talk about this? Do you find some of your peers sort of becoming more sexually active at an earlier age because it's sort of expected? Or
I used to be part of this youth group, SOAR, Sexuality Outreach Advocacy and Resources, and we got trained on, like, certain topics about sex and stuff like that, and we would teach it to our peers because the rates of, like, pregnancy and STDs and STIs and all that stuff, they were up. So they're the pregnancy rates are decreasing. But I don't have an issue talking about sex. I don't think it should be something that we have an issue with when people are having sex at younger ages. I don't have an issue talking about it. I tell my friends about it. I try to educate them what's respectful and what's not, and what's appropriate, what's not, and stuff like that. So I try to talk to them.
We'll close with a conversation with Daphne Pariser, the founder and president of an organization called Humans for Education. Pariser is getting her graduate degree in immunology at the University of Rochester. After traveling to parts of Africa, she decided to create an organization dedicated to improving education and healthcare in rural Kenya.
Here's Pariser telling the story of a young child who nearly died because his family couldn't afford a $7 hospital bill.
Children under the age of 5, if they get malaria, they are susceptible to getting it in their brain. And if they get it in their brain, they have a high chance of it being fatal. So David and I, our employee in Kenya, we were on the road to go pick up some cows. And we saw this mother and this baby. They were walking. And we knew there was no town in any direction for quite a while. So we picked them up and we asked, you know, where are you going? What's going on? And I noticed that her baby was kind of, I thought he was asleep at first, but then I realized that his head was doing this thing, and it looked like he was going in and out of consciousness. So I asked her, you know, what the issue was, and it turns out that he had malaria, and he was 3 years old at the time, and so we knew that it was really serious. So we got him to a clinic, and we get to this clinic, and it's a clinic in the middle of nowhere that it's a hut, has basically no materials, no supplies. They can't even validate that he has malaria because they don't have the proper equipment for it. They just assume based on symptoms. So they were going to give him some treatment. It was going to cost $7 for the treatment, for the mother to get a ride back to her village, and to come back for another visit the next day to make sure the kid was okay. $7 for the whole thing. The mother breaks into tears because she doesn't have the money to pay for it. These people live on less than $2 a day. So a $7, you know, bill is extremely expensive for them. So literally the day before, we had two donors who donated $5 each. So I called both of them from Kenya and I said, hey, can we use this money for this mother and this child? And they both said yes. And they gave the child the medication that he needed, and we got a phone call from the mother every single day for 2 weeks to tell us that he was okay and that he was getting better, and he had started walking, and now he's talking, and now he's, you know, able to use his motor skills and all of these different things, and now he's in school and he's getting good grades and he's 5 years old. And, you know, these two donors gave $5 each and literally saved a child's life.
And you still can kind of track that relationship? You still hear?
Oh, yeah. We hear from her every time we're there. In a good way. She is so grateful because, you know, that child's life was in danger. And so every time we're there, she makes a point to come and tell us that everything is okay. You know, and so this is the reason that we want to build a clinic, because this lady was walking almost 20 miles away from her home to get care at a clinic that didn't even have the appropriate things that they needed to treat this child. And so, you know, having a clinic that's closer by, that has all the equipment, that has all the medication, is extremely important for this community.
And that's another edition of Weekend Connections, the podcast. You can hear Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, on WRUR 88.5 FM, and on WEOS, Finger Lakes Public Radio 89.5 FM.
We are also on the WXXI mobile app. He's Evan, I'm Megan. Have a great weekend, everyone. We'll talk to you Monday.